He met the sitter for his words and loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So when we look at our practice, so whether we're Buddhists or like some of the Buddhist teachings, we have to in a way be like a scientist. So a scientist doesn't just blindly believe in everything. They do like experiments, and then through their own actions, well, this is like a proper scientist. If you go back to when science in the 1700s, the scientific method we have was developed, if they didn't understand anything, they would keep looking at it until they worked out why it was that way. And so, you know, we've done lots of things with science in the world, but the science of the mind hasn't progressed that much. You know, we think when we look at a brain in a scan and do something with chemicals, we're amazing. But, you know, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha taught us the science of the mind. Because, you know, all of the problems that we have in our own lives and in the world all come from this very mind. You know? So if we don't learn the science of the mind, if we don't learn what is good and what is not good to begin with, then we're going to keep burning ourselves. Because if we pick up a molten ball of lava, whether we touch it on the top or the bottom or the left or the right, or we throw it at somebody else, anyway, we're going to get burned. And no matter how many times we pick up that ball of lava, we still burn ourselves. And then that's the analogy for when we're not practicing. So every time we're not practicing, we don't have mindfulness, we don't have the precepts, and we don't have the Dhamma in our hearts, then we can accidentally get things wrong. And when we get things wrong and then the Dhamma falls from our hearts, then we suffer. And that's the suffering that the Buddha taught us to solve. Because if we take on the suffering of the whole world, we're trying to fix everybody else before we fixed ourselves. Well, the path to help the world is the path of being a Buddha. So that's living countless lifetimes of perfecting yourself. So the why a Buddha is unique is they're a being who've done the work. They're the embodiment of the Dhamma. So there's like a Dhamma Dhatu, the Dhamma element, which is like the element of truth or the law of how things really are. And so when a Buddha becomes an enlightened being, from the moment they become enlightened to the moment they die and extinguish into the parinibbana, that's the nothing that they say or do or think is wrong. It's like perfect. Every single action that they do is perfect. And it's said that a Buddha is one of the only being who doesn't have any of their charita left. They don't have any character left. They're purely living in accordance to Dhamma. Where an Arahant, because an Arahant is an enlightened being who follows the teachings of a Buddha, takes it on board, and then proves it in themselves and realizes the extinguishment of suffering in their own hearts. But they still have their character, you know. So that's the difference. And you notice any Arahant, that they're always respectful of the Buddha. So you never find an Arahant who isn't pointing back at the Buddha. So somebody who says they're enlightened, if they're pointing all over the place, then they're probably not enlightened. Because, you know, very rare for a being to be a Buddha. And yeah, I've said it before, there was only in the last 92 universes, there's only been 9 Buddhas. And of those Buddhas, there's only been 4 or something like that who've actually taught the Dhamma. So the idea of the Dhamma wheel rolling down to us, it's the wheel of Dhamma that was put in motion by the Buddha and kept in motion by the Bhante Sariputta, the foremost in wisdom of the Buddha's disciples. You know, that's actually rare. So I mean, when we come to practice the Dhamma, we have to remind ourselves that, you know, this is more important than our immediate pleasures that are in the world. You know, because we have so many pleasures in this world now. I mean, we don't even get soot on the ceilings when we cook anymore. Like, we're just so, like, particularly in the West, we're so protected from any kind of physical suffering. Our lives are, yet look how much I learned not long ago that in Australia the main cause of death between 15 and 49 is actually suicide in Australia. You know, so even though we have all of this physical wealth, you know, it doesn't lead to spiritual wealth. Because even at the time of the Buddha, he said that even in that generation, you know, that people were like restless and agitated. So what would have he said about this generation? So it's not that we give ourselves a hard time, but I like the teachings of Tan Pu Dom. He said, you know, to begin with, it's not like we're going to extinguish the defilements, you know. So it's like you don't just become a soldier in one day. You have to train. You have to learn. You've got to do all of the training and you prepare, and then one day you're a soldier. And the same with killing the defilements in the heart. You don't just do that in one day. So you've got to learn what your strengths and weaknesses are. Or the other analogy is, it's like a baby, you know. A baby doesn't just wake up one day and start running. No, first it learns to crawl, and then it learns to stand, and then it learns to walk, and then it learns to run. And if the parent just tells the child off all the time, well, the baby's going to end up neurotic. So you need to, with our own practice, it's kind of like whatever analogy works, but it's a process that's involved. There's a science behind it. We don't just suddenly overcome all of our defilements one day when we wake up. You know, it doesn't just happen without any work. And so there has to be karmic forces. And karma literally means action. So we're all familiar with the term karma, but then the other side of karma is vipaka. So you have karma, action, and result. And that's the same as our scientific method. That's how you get a hypothesis in science. Through observation, through action and result, until eventually you come up with a hypothesis, and enough people agree on it, and then you call it science. And then 100 years later, they change it because they realize something else. But in Buddhism, it's like the Buddha just, he said it's like he was in a forest teaching the monks, and he just picked up a few leaves off the forest floor, dead leaves, and he said, which is more, monks, the leaves in the palm of my hand or the leaves in the forest? And the monks were like, well, of course, the leaves in the forest are far more. And then he, because, you know, there's millions, billions of leaves in a forest. And these are just like, you know, 10, 20 leaves in his hand. And he said, well, you know, these are the things that are going to lead you to the end of suffering, the leaves in his hand. And the forest is like what he actually knows. Because when a Buddha awakens to the Dharma, they can actually see the interworking nature of all the karma of all beings. They can see whatever they want to see. They can point their mind towards that, and they can understand it, the laws of it or whatever. So even though a Buddha knows infinite amount of worldly things, probably science far better than our world could ever even comprehend, he didn't teach those things because they're not beneficial. But what is beneficial? You know, learning precepts is beneficial because that prevents us from going to hell. Learning meditation is beneficial because that purifies our heart of unwholesome states. Learning to be wise and associating with wise people is good because then we get right view and we know what is and is not the Dhamma. And then when we associate more with what is and is not the Dhamma, then it's easy for us to apply that to our lives. It's like generosity. You know, the Buddha almost... every time when I've looked, when he's first teaching lay people, like if he's gone on a dana, lunchtime dana or something, he always starts with generosity. Because generosity is close to renunciation. You know, lay people like their money, they like their houses, but they don't like giving it away. And, you know, as monks, because we meditate, we have to learn to renounce in order to meditate. But what's good about generosity is I was always a generous person, even before I knew the precepts. And generosity makes you genuinely happy if you reflect on it. And then because you have happiness, you can be more thankful and grateful. And then that's actually what the Buddha said, the mark of a true person is somebody who's thankful and grateful. So it means you always know how to count your blessings. So you're not looking at all the bad things in your life, you're always looking at the good things. You know? And Sariputta once layman who was hanging around the monks, and he was really poor and destitute, and so he used to get the leftover monks' food from the monks. And then one day he'd given some food to Sariputta, so he'd given the food that he'd been given from the monks to Sariputta. And then years later, this man decided he wanted to become a monk. And then, if somebody doesn't look particularly suitable, then what they usually do is they ask if anybody can remember when this person has done something good in the past. And then Sariputta recalled the time when this man gave him, you know, a bit of the food from his bowl. So even though he was destitute and had nothing, he still gave something away. And then that was enough for Sariputta. And then the Buddha's like, okay, Sariputta, you can ordain this man. And then And even though he wasn't particularly intelligent or destitute, in that long time he became an arahant because he was trainable. And so if he hadn't have done that one good act, or however many good acts, then that action, that result would have never occurred, and that door would have never opened. And so that's why, you know, the Buddha teaches us how to look at things in life. So if there's a sick person, we shouldn't be disgusted at that because we have that same nature. One day we might become sick. So if somebody's sick in our family, you know, this body is oozing all sorts of things. And so you just got to, that's a part of life. There's no point being disgusted and humiliated. That's just nature. You know, it's inside all of us. We can't hide from it. So So if we're ever treating a sick person, then we just accept that. That's part of life. There's no point being humiliated and disgusted. And one day, you know, we might be old or really sick and somebody else will be helping us. So it's like this is just a part of life. And the same with death. You know, we shouldn't hide from death. You know, when you have an opportunity to see an open casket or something, look what a dead person is, because that's a part of life as well. And we shouldn't hide from death. And so when we have this kind of attitude, and then with our possessions as well, you know, just think one day our house might burn down, one day our car might crash, one day our favorite Tupperware might get stolen, or whatever it is. But that's a part of life. So if we contemplate these things, you know, when we use them, and then it's like what Ajahn Chah said, you know that the glass has a crack in it. So the glass always has a crack in it. The cup always has a crack in it. So one day it's going to break. And so with that kind of understanding, that's the Buddha's teaching, that all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And these few things are from the Buddha's regular recollections, called the five regular recollections, and they're for lay people. And then he has 10 regular recollections for the monks. And these are things that, so even though, yes, we're meant to develop the samatha, but the reason why the Buddha has these kind of regular recollections is these are the things that are going to build wisdom. Because when we die, what's our biggest attachment? It's our body. You know? I know I'm dead. Well, how are you dead if that's your body there and you're not attached to it anymore? And your mind's always changing and so on. And so if we don't contemplate these things before they actually happen, then when they do happen, we're not going to be ready for it, you know. Because actually, if, you know, the stages of enlightenment, so by the time a being is an arahant, when they die, their mind goes into like the state of extinguishment. So it's like basically they've perfected themselves like a god. And then at that moment of death, their mind is able to just cover everything with equanimity, so there's no desire for becoming, and that's like the Dhamma element. And what it is, the Buddha doesn't really say much about. He says it's to be experienced by the wise. You know, it's both the extinguishment of suffering, so we all have this fire of suffering in our heart, so an arahant is somebody who's extinguished that flame. But it's also vast, like the great ocean, hard to describe. Like, how do you describe the ocean? You know, all rivers flow out into the ocean, but once they're the ocean, they're no longer the rivers. It's just the ocean. But we can say the word ocean, but it doesn't really signify much, does it, compared to the ocean? And that's like nibbana. It's like, how do you explain it? And so rather than the Buddha arguing about these things, he would just say, you know, do the work. And so for monks, the classic teaching is eat little, sleep little, talk little, practice a lot. So once you've got right wisdom, which, you know, if you're living under a wise teacher or following the teachings of an arahant, and that's usually enough. And then really all we have to do is do the practice and keep reminding ourselves that we don't know. You know? Because the Buddha would teach his disciples that the Buddha is the teacher. So what was the actual... It said, the Buddha is the teacher, I am a disciple. The Buddha knows, I do not know. Because if the Buddha is the Dhamma element, then all the Dhamma grows out of that. And so the old simile of one of the arahants was that the Buddha is like the roots and the trunk, and the disciples are like the branches and the leaves. And I said, all comes from that. So it's hard to fathom the Buddha, And then also the Buddha is the Dhamma is the Buddha, because the Buddha is like the Dhamma element. So if it wasn't for the Buddha perfecting himself through those countless lifetimes, it's like four asankhyas, 100,000 kalpas, and one kalpa is a universe, so incredibly long amount of time, he wouldn't have perfected himself, and then there wouldn't have been that Buddha, and then those teachers wouldn't be here today. And so the reason I'm just saying all of this is it's, it's hard, I think, in this modern age, because, you know, people have got their jobs and their families and their televisions and their phones and their children's and their radios and all these things to distract them. And their governments and their prescriptions and all these things. But just getting things just in enough order where we find the time to practice. We find the time to be generous. We find the time to help our neighbors, help our sick family members, to bring a bit of peace into our communities. You know, these are the things that matter. You know, when we die, we can't take money with us. So the reason why the Buddha didn't mind if disciples were rich or not is because if you were rich, then you can be more generous. You can donate whole monasteries. You know, so some of the disciples who were rich at the time of the Buddha, they went straight into the heavenly realms because their gifts were greater. So this idea that rich people are bad isn't true. It's just rich people need to be generous as well. But then on the other side of things, the closer you're getting to the enlightenment, the less things you need. So by the time of being as an anagami, which is the stage just before enlightenment, which means they've passed through the body and no longer associate with the four elements, first four elements as self. So earth, water, wind, fire, the body parts, these things no longer have any hold on an anagami. And so that being has no use for money anymore. They have no use for lust anymore. They've gone through these things, anger. And now they're just down to the subtle defilements of the mind. And obviously, you know, we all just start where we are. And so that's why I like the analogy of the baby. You know, so every time, rather than being harsh with yourself, we don't go shout at a baby like, "You bad baby!" Well, maybe if it burnt itself with fire or you were doing it out of compassion or something, but you wouldn't like do that every time the baby did something wrong or the baby would end up neurotic. And so the analogy is with our practice. The way we have to encourage ourselves is, you know, with gentleness and patience. So we don't let ourselves off the hook all the time, just eat from the candy jar. If you do that to a child, if they just ate potato chips and candy all day long, they wouldn't turn into a very good human being. And same with the spiritual life. So we've got to know how to restrain ourselves and encourage ourselves and tell ourselves off all at the right time. And so that process means that then we can see what our worst defilements are and also see how we practice, because we're all slightly different. So if you go to the arahants in Thailand, the ones that I've listened to, they all just teach you that it's your proper means. Like the first real thing, once you have faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, is mindfulness. So how do we have more mindfulness in the day? And, you know, through the little activities and things that we're doing, you know, are we being really present? You know, do we have our heart focused on spiritual things, or are we just off in our head somewhere? Or are we thinking about other things? And so that mindfulness is really the kind of first step. And so that's why in Thailand they have the Buddha. And the good thing about having a mantra is like a Buddha, Buddha. And you can use it all day. You can use it as your meditation object, and you can also use it as your mindfulness object. Or another one is awareness of body postures. So you know what your body's doing, like feeling your body from inside out and just being like inside your body. Or whatever the mindfulness technique is that works for you. And that's really the first step. And then for the meditation, then we find the proper meditation means for us. Ideally, breath meditation is taught a lot because breath meditation stills thoughts. But, you know, none of the Thai Ajahns would ever tell you off if you had a different meditation object and it was working for you. And so there are different meditation objects people can explore. But the point is, don't just try a different one every day and never, you know, dig 100 holes and never get an inch deep, you know. So you need to find something that works. When I first started, I actually found it very hard to meditate. So I did more walking meditation and also did casino meditation. Just because my mind was restless, I found it easier to do a mantra looking at a single spot with open eyes. And then I did the breath meditation and also the metta meditation. So I had a few, but it was just, to begin with, you're just trying to captivate your mindfulness. So if you're a really restless person, maybe you have to experiment. But then over time, the more you practice, then you find that It's like, to begin with, it might take a year or a month for the bucket to overfill. But then the more you meditate, then it only takes, 3 weeks, and then 2 weeks. And then before you know it, every time you meditate, you're getting peace. And then the real foundation for practice is a peaceful mind. Because when we have a peaceful mind, to begin with, it's like we're coming back to the eye in the storm. So it doesn't matter what's going around in the world when we're meditating, and we can still our mind. But eventually, when we practice enough, we become like the Himalayan mountain. It doesn't matter what's going on in the world or in our lives. The storms rage, lightning strikes, and you're just there. It doesn't matter. You're just doing your thing. Because at the end of the day, the world the Buddha's talking about is sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and thought. This is where suffering is. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. This is where all our problems come from. The external world, we can't end the suffering in other people's hearts. It's a long, long, long journey. Well, we can by becoming Buddhas and helping other people to become enlightened. But the Buddha didn't really teach that path, because the amount of people who aspire to do that and the amount of people who actually become Buddhas or Pacheka Buddhas are very small. The amount of arahants are much larger. So I believe in the arahant path and recommend it. And starting where we're at, everybody, maybe people don't want to aspire for that. So then we just look at our lives and we see, well, from the Buddha's teachings, what can we apply? And there's many, many teachings to fix our lives. So we look at our lives and we see, do we need more self-discipline? Do we need to be more inspired and resolved in our work so we can turn it into a craft? Do we need to be better in our families? Do we need to be better in our communities and societies? Do we need to meditate more? And do we need more metta? And the good thing about the Brahmaviharas is wherever you go, so the four divine Brahmaviharas, is then the devas will look after you. And the heavenly beings, because they know that scent, because that's what in their own hearts. And then the more you practice, if you ever go astray or have difficulties in your life, the devas will know what's happening, because you're kind of like one of them. It takes a being to be focused on really good things in their life to have that level of brightness. Because somebody who has the four Brahmaviharas in their heart, the divine abidings, it's like their hearts are luminous. It doesn't take them long meditating and everything's bright. And they have that brightness. And so I think that the gentleness and patience and just knowing where we are, gauging our practice, so when if we ever fall off the path, we learn from it and then put things right. But also we know when to encourage ourselves and when to tell ourselves off. Just like we're parenting ourselves, we've got to be our own teacher. We apply the teachings, but we need a method. If we don't have a method, it's just like watching television every night. It's not going to lead you very far. It might be fun, but it doesn't lead to anything amazing. And actually, I never had a TV antenna until some people moved into my house. But years ago. But I think that's an important thing, actually, is that the more you meditate, you realize what you put into your mind is what you end up thinking about. You are what you think. And so if you want your life to move in a good way, then we need to structure our lives so the things that we're putting into our lives are actually aligned with our highest values. So if we want to become a disciple of the Buddha or perfect ourselves in some way, we need to associate with what values are going to get us there and to be like a humble and wise person on that path. But also then we need to do the actions that are going to get us there. Nobody became enlightened by wishing it so. Nobody became the best carpenter in the world by wishing it so. Or whatever it is, nobody became develop the Brahma Wihara is just by hoping that they might have good things in their lives. You know, they had to do the work. And then the more people do the work, then that's like better than going and fixing the world, because by fixing our own lives, you know, we're influencing the people around us. And so it's like a positive knock-on effect, you know. Doesn't seem like much, but it's amazing, you know, associating with good things. So if we can be our own teacher by just, because the Buddha said, you know, if you study the teachings, you open all the Buddhist books and you read all these things, if you don't put it into action, it doesn't really lead to anything, you know. So then you're just born and die and born and die and born and die, and you might go to heaven, you might go to hell, but you don't really evolve to that next level. So the purpose of the Buddhist path is a way out of suffering. So if we don't recognize suffering, that's why in the Four Noble Truths, the first one is suffering, because suffering is to be known. So if we don't realize that we've got suffering in our lives, well, maybe we should meditate on suffering for a while. Because, you know, that's why I was saying it's like the ball of fire. Because, you know, you just see it in happiness. So think of the happiness, you know, when you're really happy about something and then that thing dissolves. Then suddenly you're sad. So happiness is also, you know, it's a double-edged sword. And so it's not that. So that's why in meditation and things, we're looking at, first of all, developing a deeper happiness, which is the happiness of peace. Because that becomes a foundation of the mind. And then with that foundation of the peace, then we develop an even deeper happiness, which is the happiness of wisdom. And then after we develop that, then we even develop the deeper happiness, which is the happiness of nibbana, which is like the extinguishment. And then even an enlightened being, once they're enlightened, they can still develop the 10 praiseworthy qualities, which is like what the great disciples of the Lord Buddha did. And they're things like, you know, one who is of few desires and speaks to the monks on few desires. So it's this whole idea of seclusion and speaks to the monks on seclusion. So it's this whole idea of these 10 core teachings, but you have to live them and then also teach people about them. So it's not that arahants have to do that, but that's the way that the Dharma actually grows in the world. It's like going to a teacher who's not interested in their subject, you know. How much do you learn from them? It's like, there's open the book, turn to page 56 and start learning. It's like, wow, it's real inspiring. But if that person actually knew it, if they'd lived it, and then they were teaching you, you know, that's inspiring. And so that's this idea of an arahant who lives those things and then also teaches, because then they become not only a field of merit for people giving, but they become like a tree for wisdom as well, for people to grow. But not everybody has that ability or desire. So it's just giving you a scope of the field of Dhamma. So we do our meditation now. For half an hour. Let's start by getting in a comfortable position. I like the word dignified. You try and be comfortable, upright, relaxed, but dignified. And depending on the mind, sometimes if you're tired, then you try to be a bit more upright. And if you're restless, then try and relax. You just look into the mind, see what state you are, and try and balance the body accordingly. So the body is relaxed and in a comfortable position. From the tips of the toe to the top of the head. Just drain out any heavy feelings through the body down into the earth. Relax the toes, the feet, the ankles, lower legs. Relax the knees, thighs, hips, weight of the body onto the seat, the chair or the cushion. Relax the lower spine and back, the middle spine and back, the upper spine, the upper back. Relax the belly. Just become aware of the belly as it rises and falls with the breathing. Very grounding. Relax the diaphragm and the solar plexus, the chest and the lungs. Just become aware of the lungs filling up and emptying. This natural process of breathing, coming more into the present. Just simplifying, calming down. Relax the shoulders deeply. You might even let the shoulders droop a little. Upright but relaxed. Relax the upper arms, elbows, lower arms, wrists, palms of the hands, the fingers, fingertips, the neck. Even notice the air passing up and down in the neck. Relax the whole of the neck. Relax the chin, all the muscles of the face, around the mouth, the nose, the cheeks, upper cheeks. Slight smile at the corners of the eyes, just letting the eyes relax. And the forehead. The whole body relaxed. And the eyes totally relaxed. Good enough. We just let the body look after itself for the rest of the meditation. It needs to move, we just do so quietly as possible in a relaxed fashion, and bring our attention to the mind or the heart, whatever you want to call it, spiritual experience of being here right now. See the tendency of the mind to go outwards. It wants to go out to sights, to sounds, to smells, to taste, to touch, to thoughts, and the emotions of thoughts. This is what it's constantly trying to do. Go out and like, dislike, and comment on everything. So we just put all these things down. So the mind doesn't have to go outside. It's okay for the mind just to be with the mind. Relaxing the mind, bringing some peace and kindness. all this busyness and restlessness of the world. When we meditate, it's like we're coming into the eye of the storm, or like the Himalayan mountain, unmoved by worldly things. It's like our respite. With this simple contentment, we can take up our meditation object. For those who need, I'll do a guided meditation. Or want. And so we'll do a guided breath meditation. So usually, if you already know type of breath meditation that suits you, you just use that. Some people can use a mantra, like Buddha or peaceful, and just do a relaxed, normal in-breath, just what you're watching, and then the out-breath is what you're watching. And then usually there's a point of focus. Beginners might find it best to follow the breath from the nostril into the chest and then coming back out to the nostril. Otherwise, at the nose, at the lip, at the heart, or at the belly. We just choose a means that seems like it will suit us, and then just do our best for the meditation. Most important thing is that we're not too tight and tense, and we're not too relaxed that we're falling asleep. We just find this middle ground, comfortable and relaxed, aware of the in-breath, aware of the out-breath. Allowing everything to settle down. And if we find the mind getting caught up with anything, we just notice and gently let go and come back to the present. There's no right or wrong, as long as we're trying. We're tense still, just really try and tune in to the peace and relaxation of the breath. And if we're dull, imagine the Buddha like a bright light in the heart. And once we've rectified the hindrance, just come back to the meditation. Buddha. Remembering to have a welcoming and friendly nature. It's like meeting a dear friend. The in-breath is a dear friend. I let it go. Out-breath is a dear friend. Let it go. The whole of the in-breath, aware of the whole of the out-breath. Sense of peacefulness and letting go. What? Oh. What? Thoughts and feelings like passing clouds. But allowing ourselves to enjoy the present, even if it's just a little bit. But, Allowing our hearts to become still and radiant. Friendly heart tuning into unshakable peace. infusing in-breath and out-breath with ease and peace and luminosity. Buddha. Buddha. Breathing in unshakable peace, breathing out unshakable peace. Just wherever one's at is good enough. But go. And share some benevolence with ourselves. May we be happy. And just see how our mind is now after this period of meditation. Is it more relaxed? Is it more calm? What was the causes? And just remind ourselves that these bodies and these things in this world are temporary. And things change. We should be prepared for that. We share the kindness of our hearts with those in this room, those on this property, the kangaroos and the birds and the devas, and any of the insects on this property. And then in Perth, Western Australia, Australia, the Southern Hemisphere, all the beings in the spiritual realm and the physical realm, seen and unseen, in the whole of the earth, whole of the cosmos, whole of the ambrosial, all the realms of existence, we share this kindness with every being equally. All beings have this ease and peace in their heart and have all suffering and difficulties extinguished in their mind. Just may we encourage ourselves to be generous, thankful and grateful, and always count the blessings in our lives. And that's the end of the meditation. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Okay, a little blessing.
(Clears throat)
Yata varivaha pura pariparenti sagarang evang eva itodinang petanang upakapati chitang patitang tung hankipameva samichatu sabe parentu sangapa chando panara soyata manichotira soyata sapitio vivachantu sabaroko vinasatu mate bhavantvantarayo sukiti kayuko bhavahapiva dhanasilisanichang Uta pachayino chaptaro dhamma vatanti ayuvanno sukhang palang pavatu sabha mangalang rakkantu sabha devata sabha bhuta nupavena sada soti pavantu te pavatu sabha mangalang Rakkantu sabba devata sabba dhamma nupavena sada soti pavantu te pavatu sabba mangalang Rakkantu sabba devata sabba sangha nupavena sada soti pavantu te
Good.